Welcome to the podcast series, Intel on AI. Each episode explores human-centric topics related to artificial intelligence through conversations with leaders in the field. I'm your host, Abigail Hing Nguyen. Hello, and thank you for joining us today. With me is Alice Xiang from the Partnership on AI. It's a nonprofit in Silicon Valley whose founding partners include Amazon, Facebook, Google, Microsoft, Apple, and IBM, along with other partners like Intel. Alice and I work together on the Partnership on AI's Fairness, Transparency, and Accountability Committee, where I serve as the co-chair of the expert group, and she is the head of research, where she's leading an interdisciplinary team researching algorithmic fairness, explainability, diversity and inclusion as it applies to AI and criminal justice, among many other pursuits. Alice, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Abigail. It's really an honor and pleasure to be here with you today.
Alice, you're involved in a number of groundbreaking projects, and I'd love to start with your work in algorithmic fairness in particular, both the recent advances and some of the challenges of trying to operationalize algorithmic fairness in practice. Can you start off by telling us about your work in this space?
Sure, thank you. So I would say that generally a lot of the work in the fairness, transparency, accountability space overall that we do at PAI is really motivated by the fact that these are really lofty principles, and a lot of folks agree that they are important and we need to be doing further work on them. But what's really challenging is the details once you get from broadly saying that you want to create a fair, more equitable algorithm to how do you actually do that in practice. And we've seen this in many different aspects of our work, in particular around algorithmic fairness. So for example, recently we conducted an interview study where we spoke with over 38 practitioners in the field of algorithmic fairness, from machine learning practitioners to lawyers, policy folks, compliance officers, all sorts of individuals who are seeing how this is actually playing out on the ground when they're trying to do bias detection and bias mitigation. And in particular, we focused on the role that demographic data has played within this and what sorts of challenges or barriers folks have encountered. And I think this is a really important area for discussion, because what folks often don't realize on the ground is, even though a lot of companies at this point are actually putting resources towards trying to make their algorithms fair, oftentimes more pragmatic barriers like having access to the right data can prevent even a detection of bias.
Could you define what algorithmic fairness is?
So I would say generally algorithmic fairness is the study of how algorithms might systemically perform better or worse for certain groups of people, and in particular the ways in which historical biases or other systemic inequities might be perpetuated by algorithmic systems. And so folks in algorithmic fairness are really trying to correct for this and ensure that any sort of products that they're releasing really work well for all different types of groups and aren't penalizing folks based on historical inequities.
Can you give some examples? There's some that are quite well known in the literature, but I'd love to hear, like, what are some of the recent ones that you're running across that people may not be so aware of?
So this comes up really in all sorts of different aspects of really any deployed algorithmic system that's being used in a high stakes context. So I think folks are most familiar, for example, in the criminal justice context with how there are disproportionately high false positive rates for Black defendants compared to white defendants. And that's due to what we see in arrest data, where there's a higher baseline arrest rate for Black defendants compared to white defendants. And in light of, you know, all of the discourse that we've seen in the US in the past few years, I think a lot of folks have come to realize that that's not simply due to crime trends across groups. It's also due to over-policing of certain communities and the potentially higher rates of wrongful arrest of certain communities as well. So if you're just taking the data at face value, you're going to end up seeing that the use of these tools could inadvertently lead to higher incarceration rates among certain communities compared to others. So that's probably the most high stakes context, but it comes up in many other cases as well. How do you ensure that healthcare diagnostic decisions are equally accurate and aren't recommending treatment at lower rates for, say, Black patients compared to white patients, which is an issue that has come up in the literature where algorithms are often, say, trained on data about healthcare costs rather than healthcare need. So if you then try to predict what people's healthcare needs are based on an algorithm trained on healthcare costs, what you get is a deprioritization of patients that have historically not necessarily received the treatment they needed.
So if we did a case study on one of these examples, especially, you know, in healthcare, how would we go about approaching that to operationalize algorithmic fairness?
Well, you first need to know what demographic categories people are in order to even check for bias. In healthcare, there's a much longer tradition of folks collecting sensitive data on race and gender in order to make diagnostic decisions. So oftentimes that's more readily available. So let's say you already have this data and you do detect a bias in your algorithm. The next question is really to figure out what is causing that. I think oftentimes what makes it so difficult to actually have any sort of off-the-shelf solutions for bias mitigation is if you actually want to truly address what's going on, you need to understand your data very deeply and the underlying causes. So for example, in this scenario, if you have an algorithm that's trained on healthcare costs rather than healthcare need, and you're using it to predict healthcare need, then you need to be thinking about what kind of trends might be encapsulated in your data such that there might be a disconnect between actual need versus cost in the past. And that might involve some sort of manipulation of the data where you change what you see based on some of these systemic trends. And this is where things get a little bit more complicated, because essentially what we mean by bias detection and bias mitigation here is you're checking for whether the scales are tilted in the favor of one group versus another when you're doing bias detection. But then bias mitigation often implies you are putting your thumb on the scale to even things out such that it's no longer tilted in favor of one group versus another group. But that act of putting the thumb on the scale is where things get very complicated and very nuanced in terms of how you do that and whether you can do that in a way that doesn't raise legal concerns and doesn't raise other ethical concerns or otherwise just make people very uncomfortable, because it often does involve some active consideration of what demographic group individuals are in.
And also who's deciding exactly what percentages to be represented. It's something I discussed on a previous podcast with Bernhard Trout from MIT, who teaches the course on AI and ethics there. Is there like a case study or an example where you feel like this has been done well?
It's funny. I would say one of the case studies that I actually like is one where there wasn't a technical solution. So in this case, it was a healthcare company that was using a model to predict health outcomes around sepsis. And they found disproportionately worse outcomes for communities where English was a second language. And instead of just approaching this as the technical problem where they needed to use some sort of algorithmic intervention, they were much closer to the whole data generating process here. So they were able to think closely about what different factors might feed into this and look at the whole data pipeline. And they realized that if they went all the way down to the sorts of resources that were being used at the hospitals where the data was being collected, there wasn't Spanish language materials, for example, around sepsis, whereas there was English language materials around that. And that was an issue that they wouldn't have identified necessarily without having this model. But once they fixed that and started introducing more Spanish language materials, it did help to close the gap somewhat.
That's an amazing piece of detective work.
Yeah, exactly. I think it was a great example of how sometimes a lot of the benefit of algorithmic systems, if used well, would be to help us detect problems rather than to help us automate decisions. And it's best used in the hands of folks who deeply understand that this data is influenced by the system that's within, such that sometimes changing the system is better than changing the model itself.
Mm-hmm. So I think there are two interesting challenges that come out of here. One is we have these algorithms in place to try to ensure more standardized outcomes to increase fairness and actually to police the humans that are operating the technology. And so when you have humans manipulating the data and making decisions about which to include and what not to include, it feels like here's a space where transparency and accountability actually are in contradiction to each other. And how do you work to police that?
Yeah, this is a really challenging issue within this space. And I think part of the problem is we don't have really great tools at the moment for making the innards of algorithmic tools more accessible to a broader audience. So a lot of the motivation behind the entire field of explainability is that people now realize that simply, say, making your code open source or releasing your data set is probably not going to solve a lot of the transparency and accountability issues that people have cited, because there's only so much you can really tell as a layperson from a code base and from the data. And also there's a huge amount of privacy concerns related to just releasing raw data about individuals. And so with all those things considered, what's arguably more helpful is if you can actually explain how a model is working or explain a specific decision that was used in an individual case. And that's really been the motivation for explainability. But what we found in our research at PAI is there's still a big gap between how we're seeing explainability being used in deployment and these loftier goals. And often understanding and interpreting the results of these explainability tools requires so much expertise in the area that it doesn't really make things more accessible.
Right. And actually, it sounds like, you know, even the type of detective work you were describing, or the diagnostic of why this system wasn't working, that requires quite a bit of knowledge or even just the right people around the table. And how do you do that in a company or, you know, even like, say, a startup that doesn't have those type of resources?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, in the explainability context, for example, we often heard practitioners say, in order for them to vet their explanations, they actually first consult with a domain expert, because they don't want to give someone an explanation like, oh, the reason your loan was denied was because of your height or something like that, which is just very obviously incorrect. And there's a lot of examples that are much more nuanced than that, where it's not obvious unless you're a domain expert. So there often is that additional layer required. And I think it really does show the importance for a diverse set of stakeholders to be working together in this space, because these are not problems where you can solve them with just machine learning experts or just legal experts or policy experts or just domain experts. It really requires a very interdisciplinary and multi-stakeholder process.
And do you see like a model going forward in the future, maybe a consulting model of groups that have expertise in this type of fairness work that have, you know, the bandwidth and the resources to hire a diverse set of interdisciplinary researchers around the table? Or do you think that the solution is going to have to be very, very local and specific to each particular company?
I think it can potentially be a combination of both. And I think in a way it'll have to be, because I mean, even what I've seen from our work at PAI is that a lot of the major tech companies now have built out pretty significant teams of their own that focus, say, on fairness or transparency or some other aspect of responsible AI. And they can do a lot on their own, but that is still something that is really challenging for startups or smaller companies to possibly compete with. It's really a large ask to ask smaller companies in the AI space to try to build up their own teams around this. And it's really a full-time job for many individuals to take on.
And so does Partnership on AI offer resources in this area? Are there things that a smaller company could access through you?
Yeah, so we are very committed to putting all of our research online available for everyone for free, because a lot of the work that we do is surfacing these insights from our multi-stakeholder community. And we hope that this can in turn serve as a valuable educational resource for folks who might be a little bit more peripheral in the conversation. Either they don't have the resources to really invest in studying these problems on their own, or say, you know, policymakers, for example, this is an important issue for them, but it's not necessarily something that each of them becomes extremely expert on. So we're very committed to creating accessible materials that can hopefully lend a more nuanced but also accessible perspective for folks, since we really believe that in order to make progress in this field, we need to have diverse voices coming together and working together on this issue. So lowering that barrier to entry is incredibly important.
Well, this is actually a good moment to kind of segue into some of your work around explainability, which we are already beginning to touch on. And I know you and I had participated last year in London and the All Hands meeting to talk about explainability and thinking about the different vectors that could go into that. Can you talk to me now about the latest thinking? Where's the research going? And what does explainability look like now?
So our initial work in this space really identified this huge gap in terms of how explainability is being used in practice, which is principally as a debugging tool by a machine learning scientist just to kind of sanity check what's going on in the algorithm, because it's much easier through explainability tools to find something that is just blatantly incorrect versus to provide reliable explanations for end users. So whereas it's a useful set of literature in terms of providing folks with some debugging tools, it's really not at the point that we ultimately want it to be in terms of people actually using this to provide transparency to external stakeholders. So as a result, we've been doing a lot of work in terms of bringing together a diverse set of stakeholders and practitioners, policymakers, academics, civil society groups to think a little bit more about what explainability would ideally do and why it's not quite servicing those goals currently. And I think a lot of the challenge does come with the fact that consistently, people do cite the need to really bring in the end users, bring in the regulators, whoever you're trying to provide explanations to, in the process of generating them. And then in addition to that, oftentimes what's missing from this conversation is the important role that uncertainty plays with actually making meaningful explanations. Because it's not enough to just say, this is the reason why this algorithmic decision was made. It's also important to say, and this is something that the model is very certain about versus it's something the model is not very certain about. Because I think oftentimes it's easy for folks to either overly trust models because it seems like it's magical or built upon so much data, so it must be true, or to simply ignore model predictions because they know of a lot of the challenges that might make these predictions not reliable.
Right. So if we were to make this specific, for example, a pregnancy test, like what likelihood is this of a false positive versus a, you know, false negative? And so when people are given the results, they're also given the probability that it's correct, in which way the thumb on the scale is weighed.
Yeah, exactly. And kind of returning to the criminal justice context for a moment as well, you know, that's an area where most of these tools cannot achieve more than a 60 to 70% accuracy rate. So given that you're talking about a binary outcome, if you knew nothing, you would get a 50% accuracy rate. So it's very important to convey the uncertainty associated with these decisions. So if a model predicts that someone has an 80% chance of recidivism, is that really 80%, or is that, well, it's really more like 50 to 100% with a mode around 80, you know, something like that is helpful context for a judge who's trying to figure out, is this a meaningful prediction?
And can you tell us about the current state of deployment of these tools? Like, they are very early stage still, and there's many things to be worked out. Are they being used right now?
Yeah, so they are actually being deployed in a lot of places. Pretty much every state uses them at some point in the criminal justice process, either pre-trial, sentencing, or parole-related decisions. A lot of movement around the proliferation of criminal justice risk assessment tools has happened as a proposed replacement to cash bail, because the way cash bail works right now is the judge will determine a bond based on the severity of the crime and also the financial resources of the defendant. And the goal is to secure that the defendant will come back and not flee while they're awaiting trial. This is in many ways a very primitive system that is quite specific to the US and very few other places. And how much money someone has and their ability to pay bond is not necessarily a good indication of whether they would flee justice and whether they are a potential risk to the community. And so some of these tools, for example, predict whether someone is likely to recidivate. And the goal there is to have something that's better than just a cash amount, essentially, that this person is paying to indicate that they are able to come back and await trial. So the motivations are very positive. The current system is very problematic. And originally, a lot of the proliferation of these tools happened at a time when folks thought, well, these tools are very objective, evidence-based, and it was part of a broader push for more evidence-based policymaking, with a realization that judges themselves might be biased, so maybe we need some sort of data-driven tool. I think in recent years, though, there has been this growing realization that these tools are by no means a panacea and in some cases can do more harm than good. And so the Partnership on AI actually last year, in response to the SB 10, Senate Bill 10 in California, which basically would try to replace cash bail in California with an algorithmic tool, PAI released a report that basically argued against the use of these tools to automate pretrial decisions because of a lot of concerns around the fairness, transparency, and accountability of these tools. So it's, I think, an interesting case study in terms of how these tools can proliferate, but also how growing research in this area can show a lot of their limitations and the ways in which they might accidentally perpetuate rather than alleviate existing biases.
So what is your conclusion overall then in terms of the deployment of these tools? It sounds like in this case, what we're seeing is that the algorithms might actually be better than leaving the decision making to humans alone.
I guess it's hard to say whether they're better, in part because by and large, these tools aren't used in isolation. They are used to ideally inform judges. And so there's this additional variable there in terms of how judges interpret them. And so my personal take on this is that I could see a role for these tools if judges are sufficiently educated about their limitations and how to properly interpret them. And also if we take a more critical lens in terms of their development process, because a lot of tool developers don't take seriously the need to mitigate algorithmic bias or to tailor the tool to the specific jurisdictions that they deploy them in. And these are all really important factors if you want to ensure that the tool is actually giving people meaningful predictions.
Well, that's very interesting. I was speaking with Professor Ben Liebman at Columbia, who heads up the China legal practice there, and he was telling me they're deploying AI tools in Chinese courts. And what they found is that it was useful to deploy them only in the sense that judges would be on better behavior because they knew they were being watched or that they were going to be measured against a baseline, not that the tools themselves were particularly helpful. So I thought that was a very interesting perspective.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've often thought as well that maybe a better use case for these tools, given that the ostensible goal is to address the fact that judges themselves might be biased. So given that, it would probably make more sense to use this as an audit of judges rather than as a tool to inform judges. I think for various political reasons, maybe that's why in the US it's manifested itself very differently than the way it's manifested itself in China. But I do think arguably that would be better way of approaching things given the original motivation of using these tools.
And so in the area of explainability, what are the other challenges or the other breakthroughs in the space that you'd like to highlight?
I think there has been a recent push in both fairness and explainability for more causally based fairness techniques and interpretability or explainability techniques. So one concrete example was with a company we were talking to who's working on emotional recognition. They had an algorithm that was a smile detector, and they also had an algorithm that was a cheek raise detector. And what they were finding was basically their cheek raise detector was just focusing on people's mouths instead of people's cheeks, because oftentimes when people smile, their cheeks also raise. So cheek raising and smiling are highly correlated. And so there, we know that causally speaking, what is relevant for cheek raising is the movement in the cheeks. But an algorithm doesn't necessarily know that if there's a lot of correlation between cheek raising and smiling with your mouth. So a lot of the challenges with using these sorts of techniques come from the fact that they are very subject to spurious correlations. And if we're able to actually get at the underlying causal mechanisms, then we can potentially create tools that aren't necessarily making decisions on the wrong features. And to give an example that makes this more relevant in the fairness context, the fundamental challenge that we have with arrest data, for example, is that there is a correlation between being Black and being arrested in the data itself. And what we really need to think about in the algorithmic fairness community is how to make sure that our models are not learning that correlation. Our models are instead learning the underlying causal mechanisms and understanding them correctly. Because causally, it's not that being Black leads to higher rates of recidivism. What's happening instead is that being Black might lead to higher rates of arrest because your community is subject to more policing, or maybe there's higher rates of wrongful arrests, or maybe other systemic factors that are causing this sort of correlation. And so I think there's a big need when we are trying to ensure that these models aren't falling for these spurious correlations to think about the underlying causes of what's going on in the data. And that's something that does require often more domain expertise and understanding beyond just of the algorithmic context itself, but of the broader system that generates these data.
Mm-hmm. I think that that's something that's still being worked through in the real world, right? There's not that many people actually who see and can recognize that underlying cause. So this is both like an incredible opportunity, but also another layer of challenge.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, part of what's so interesting to me about this space is that in a way, a lot of the problems we're facing in responsible AI are not at all new problems. They're issues that people have been really trying to figure out since the dawn of human civilization. So what does it mean to have a fair outcome, for example, or what does it mean for a system to deserve trust? And what's interesting and complicated in the algorithmic context is because algorithms are so literal and so quantitative, these very abstract issues that over human history, we've gotten more comfortable talking about in qualitative ways or in more abstract ways, we suddenly have to make extremely concrete. And because there's no singular right answer to these questions, I think there's a lot of question of what is the process that we follow such that we can iterate in a meaningful way, such that there's still some accountability for whatever solutions we do end up pursuing.
And so this is, I think, one of the hardest questions to solve of all. Like, and it's something I discussed with Bernhard Trout as well. His suggestion was that we pursue this, you know, on a federated level where the local decision makers are deciding what's fair. But how do we address this? Like, what kind of a system do you think we can create?
Yeah, I mean, I think kind of based on the existing structures in place, I do think there needs to be a much bigger role of government audits. I think it's really going to be hard for tech companies themselves to, say, replicate the legitimacy of an overall democratic system. And I think one of the values of democracy is we recognize that the answers are not going to be right per se, but they will be right from the standpoint of some sort of procedure that we've all agreed upon is fair. So I think there's a certain legitimacy to government entities that will be hard to find with any other entities.
I do agree there's going to be a role for the law and policy to play in this. And you yourself hold a degree from Yale Law School. Can you tell me more about some of the work that you've done at the intersection of law and AI fairness?
So one of the issues that's really been keeping me up at night is a lot of the collisions that happen when we try to apply our existing prudence to the context of algorithms. So since I specialize a lot in algorithmic fairness and mitigating algorithmic bias in my work, I'm really worried that we might end up in a situation where the way our laws and policies evolve and apply to algorithms might actually make it impossible for practitioners to meaningfully mitigate bias in practice. Basically, the fundamental problem boils down to a broader tension we have in American society between colorblindness and race consciousness in decision making. So the problem with bias mitigation and algorithms is that in order to actually do anything about algorithmic bias, you kind of have to make a decision that is to some extent influenced by the protected attribute. And so what I mean by that is it's very similar to what we see in affirmative action and the debates around affirmative action in the US. So if you actually want to actively change the fact that we have disproportionate outcomes in terms of the lack of diversity in higher education, you need to actually actively consider individuals' demographic attributes when you're making admissions decisions. So it's a very similar concept in the algorithmic fairness context. And affirmative action jurisprudence is unfortunately a space where, you know, it's constantly under threat and it's just maybe one Supreme Court decision away from being invalidated. And I think not enough folks are talking about the fact that even though we've all heard the arguments maybe in the higher education affirmative action context, this might have very significant impacts on what we're able to do or not do around algorithmic bias. And I think none of us want to live in a world where biased algorithms proliferate
I completely agree. I think it really underscores the importance of technologists and policymakers working closely together to figure this out. So let's chat a bit about your work now in diversity and inclusion. I know PAI is doing really incredible work in this space, and I'd love to hear what some of the highlights are, some of the advances, and how your team is thinking about it.
Yeah, sure. So this is our newest line of work that we recently launched within the Fairness, Transparency, Accountability umbrella. Basically, we've launched with an interview and survey study where we're trying to get a sense of what are some of the cultural factors that lead to a feeling of exclusivity in the field of AI among women and minoritized individuals. And we think this is really important because at a time when there is growing awareness of some of the diversity and inclusion issues in the field of AI, companies have certainly been putting some money towards initiatives and such, but there isn't necessarily a really deep understanding of what initiatives work, what don't, and really hearing from the perspectives of the folks actually on the ground in terms of their experiences. And I mean, the study has been motivated both by a lot of conversations that I've had with partners, but honestly also, you know, my own personal experiences and those of my friends in the field of AI. There has been research that has shown a lot of the focus, say, on diversity trainings is probably not the most effective. And that's research kind of outside of the AI field, just in terms of diversity and inclusion in general. So, for example, the really watershed gender shades paper was motivated by folks realizing that AI systems weren't working for them. The facial recognition algorithms weren't detecting their faces properly. So I think it's really important to consider who's around the table when we are designing these systems, given how impactful they may be. And a key part of that is ensuring that AI teams foster a more inclusive environment.
That is actually the example that has been given frequently where having a diverse audience around the table really made a difference. It was in recognizing like this facial recognition algorithm is not working on me. Are there other examples like that where we found a benefit from having that diversity at the table?
There have been studies outside of the AI field in terms of the importance of diversity, in terms of flagging a lot of potential issues and having more creative decision making. But I mean, I would also say just in my own personal experience, actually my interest in algorithmic fairness started when I was a data scientist working on designing a machine learning algorithm. And I was basically given carte blanche in terms of designing this algorithm to predict whether individuals are interested in new job opportunities. And so that's a really tricky question. And, you know, what features you think are relevant to that question are really dictated a lot by your own background. Having gone to a large public high school in Appalachia growing up, I knew there were plenty of folks who had very different career trajectories than myself, and their life stories would probably not be reflected in whatever algorithm I designed.
Could you share what those might be or some examples, what their factors might be that were different?
Yeah, for example, I grew up in a small industrial town where a large portion of the population worked for one major company. And so there, it's very unlikely that people would be changing jobs to go to a different company if they were working in that industry. That's very different from the type of individuals that were more reflected in my data set, who were often folks who were college educated, living in large cities, and frequently moved around, not only between different companies, but often in, you know, different sectors. And that's just not the life experience of someone who's working in a small town that has one major employer in terms of what they might be looking for in their job trajectory. In this case, it was a large chemical company. Moving jobs might entail, you know, moving to a totally different place. And that's also an important factor as well. For a lot of people, it's not that easy to move to a totally different part of the country just for your job. And that in turn, you know, limits what kinds of job opportunities you'd be interested or how often you'd be interested in changing jobs.
Yeah. And so maybe what you're highlighting is like some regional differences too, right? So if the algorithms are being built here in Silicon Valley, the onus is on us to educate ourselves, to recognize we are missing perspectives from all these various other groups and other demographics.
Yeah, exactly. I think a lot of algorithmic bias does come from the fact that it is just really hard to see outside of your own experience and your own interpretation of the data. And sometimes it does just take someone with a different perspective to highlight some of the limitations there.
Alice, we just have a few minutes left, and I would love to hear what brought you to this space yourself and what are some of your hopes for your work going forward?
So my background is pretty interdisciplinary. I have degrees in statistics, economics, and law. And I really came at this inspired by my own experiences in industry and realizing that there are a lot of folks in industry that are concerned about these issues and don't really have great guidance in terms of how do you reconcile all of the technical complexities with all the legal concerns and with all of the ethical issues as well. And so I really wanted to be someone to help bridge these gaps, since I do think this is a conversation that needs to be extremely interdisciplinary and have folks from industry, from policy, and from the, you know, civil society and the broader public engaged. So that's what really drew me to this space. And so my goal really is to be someone who's able to build bridges and hopefully make it such that we can all work together towards building more equitable algorithms.
Alice, thank you again. It's been such a pleasure to do a deeper dive into the work that you've been doing at Partnership on AI.
Thank you, Abigail. I've really appreciated this opportunity to speak with you here today and engage with your audience, and I'm looking forward to future conversations.